My friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and we have an extraordinary rendition of the show for you today. Our first guest is Scott Horton, no relation to myself. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights. He's a partner in the law firm Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, the president of the Andrei Sakharov Foundation, and former director of the Council on Foreign Relations Center for Preventive Action. He's an adjunct professor at Columbia University School of Law and head of the New York Bar Association's Committee on International Law. Welcome to the show, sir.
Well, hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I guess for the remainder of the interview, I'll be Scott and you be Mr. Horton.
That's fine with me.
Okay, good. Let's see here. On February 10th, a German prosecutor dismissed a war crimes complaint against Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld just in time for him to attend a NATO conference in Munich, saying, quote, "There are no indications that the U.S. authorities and courts have refrained or would refrain from taking penal steps related to the abuse cited in the criminal complaint," end quote. Mr. Horton, you wrote a brief for that German court. Why, and did they take your advice?
Well, actually, their decision didn't reflect in any way the opinion I wrote for that. My opinion dealt with a technical issue, which was the existence of original jurisdiction in Germany. I think the decision that came down from the German prosecuting authorities certainly isn't surprising, and I think you indicated already in your remarks that this was on the eve of the Munich NATO summit, and it's quite clear that this was a politically dictated decision. That is, they didn't want to embarrass the American Secretary of Defense on the eve of this summit. But the decision that was handed down really left the door open. They said that this is too early, in fact, after the war crimes allegations coming out of Iraq, for a country other than the United States to begin to exercise universal jurisdiction on war crimes.
Okay, and in your brief, you were saying, basically making the argument that you thought that the American authorities would indeed refrain from having a real investigation and real prosecutions of these crimes.
Right. I discussed in some detail the criminal investigations that have occurred already, which were Article 15-6 investigations under the Department of the Army rules. And I said that these investigations look down the chain of command. That is, they deal with infractions at a low level, but they don't look up the chain of command. So I said these investigations don't show that there is an investigation into the potential wrongdoing of policymakers.
And under what jurisdiction would the Germans, regardless of the degree that the American government is doing the right thing, what jurisdiction would the German government have over Donald Rumsfeld and his actions as relating to Iraq?
Well, certain criminal acts have historically been viewed as subject to universal jurisdiction. So that means that all countries have jurisdiction to punish them. And that's included piracy and war crimes historically. But to say that universal jurisdiction exists doesn't mean that a country should exercise it, because they should give deference first to the country that has the most direct relationship to the criminal activities, which in this case, of course, is the United States.
So really, it's up to us to prosecute our government for war crimes before some foreigners get a hold of them.
I think that's right, yes.
How did you get involved in this issue in the first place, Mr. Horton?
Well, I was contacted in this case by some lawyers who brought this complaint with the German prosecutors, and they asked me if I would give them an opinion dealing with this universal jurisdiction issue, and I agreed to do it. So I really didn't have any involvement in the underlying move to bring this case in Germany.
All right. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm interviewing Scott Horton. We'll be right back on the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm interviewing Scott Horton. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights. And, sir, from what I read, you were sitting in your office one day, and some military JAG lawyers came to see you. Why would they ever do such a thing as that?
Well, it wasn't in my office. I was the chair of a committee at the Bar Association, and they came to the Bar Association. And the matter got passed over to me. That's how it happened. But why would they do that? Indeed, it certainly puzzled me when it first happened. Of course, the people who came and visited were lawyers, and some of them are members of our association. So it's not unusual for our members to come and raise questions with us. But these lawyers had a particular concern, that, and this goes back to May of 2003. They were concerned that decisions were being taken at the top of the Pentagon and the Office of the Secretary of Defense that were going to lead to abuse of detainees, and they wanted to get the Bar Association involved with these issues.
And this was in May of 2003, so this is only just after the Iraq War had started.
A few months after the Iraq War started, that's right.
Okay, so...
And I have to say, when they came, it really didn't strike me that it was about, that their concerns were about Iraq, frankly. They didn't specify in terms of location, but, you know, my suspicion was that it must have had to have done more with Guantanamo, which was emerging as an issue at that time.
I see, because it wasn't until later in that year, I guess about 6 months later, that Rumsfeld had the famous meeting where he said, I want to Gitmoize the interrogation procedures in Iraq.
That's right. That would have been around July.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought it was in the fall of 2003.
Mm-hmm. No, in the fall of 2003, at the end of August, is when Major Miller actually arrived in Iraq.
I see. And this all goes back to the end of 2001, the beginning of 2002, and the memos prepared for the Bush White House by the Justice Department and the Department of Defense outlining what would be proper and improper interrogation procedures, right?
That's correct. And some of those memos have now come out. They're in the public domain. Others have not. In fact, just in the last few weeks, the existence of one memorandum that talks about specific interrogation practices and approves them, the existence of that memo has become known, but we still don't know the text of it.
I see. And Mr. Gonzalez's memo, the new Attorney General of the United States, his memo makes the argument that in fighting al-Qaeda, that this is a brand new kind of war, and that the Geneva Convention and the manners in which war is to be carried out that it describes are quaint and obsolete when confronted with this group of terrorists that are, after all, less than a state. Does that argument hold any water at all?
Well, I think you can understand that he's dealing with a situation where the U.S. has decided to treat this as a war rather than as an international criminal investigation and prosecution. And governments up to that point, including the Israeli government, the British government, had dealt with acts of terrorism under the rubric of criminal law. So he was taking a leap. And when you take that leap to warfare and you call it a war, then you invoke the law of war, the law of armed conflict. And the law of armed conflict includes at the center of it the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Convention, the Convention Against Torture, a few other documents. I think having first characterized it as a war and then looking at the legal limitations on the conduct of warfare, they realized that this wasn't necessarily such an adept way to go forward. So I think what was happening in those memoranda was some very rapid legal backpedaling. And the position that was being staked out, I mean, saying that the Geneva Conventions were quaint and outmoded was, I think, a ridiculous thing to say, a very unfortunate thing to say. And it led to a number of problems in the field, in Iraq in particular, which have greatly undermined the United States' cause in combating terror.
What about the part of the Gonzalez memo that says, basically instructs the president that if you find in a determination, these are all legal terms, if you find in your determination that Geneva does not apply, then any domestic federal laws that outlaw violating the Geneva Conventions will be moot, and well, not apply. Does that hold water from a legal standpoint?
Well, the risk, of course, is that he might be wrong, and in fact, he was wrong. But, you know, the objective here is, Judge Gonzalez was quite clear about, both in the memorandum and in his testimony, is he was concerned about senior figures in the government being held to account for war crimes in connection with the conduct of the war. And he said, if you make this determination and make a determination that the Geneva Conventions don't apply, then there's no way that any senior official of the government can be held accountable for a war crime. The problem with this analysis is that it assumes that a presidential determination of this sort is the end-all to the subject, which it's not. And it had a rather simplistic idea of what the war was going to be, because this was all written in the backdrop of the weeks leading up to the military engagement in Afghanistan. But, of course, as you know, that war unfolded subsequently to include Iraq. And a lot of what Judge Gonzalez wrote in that memo was received out in the field in Iraq, was interpreted in Iraq, and led to mistakes being made by military personnel, many of whom are now facing prosecution.
You wrote in the LA Times that calling Geneva obsolete was used against the Nazis during the war crimes tribunal at Nuremberg after World War II, that them using the term obsolete to describe Geneva was cited as aggravating circumstances in pushing for the death penalty.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the former American Attorney General, Robert H. Jackson, who at that point was a justice of the American Supreme Court on leave, handled the prosecution in the initial phase of the Nuremberg tribunal. One of the defendants there was the head of the German Wehrmacht, Wilhelm Keitel. And Jackson, in presenting the case against Keitel, cited as a particular aggravation in his justification for the death penalty the fact that Keitel had said the Geneva Convention was obsolete.
You told David Brancaccio on PBS Now that the memos on your inspection of the memos, that they were completely ignorant of not just the reason for, moral reasons for wanting, or even pragmatic reasons for wanting to go along with Geneva, but were actually quite ignorant of even how the Geneva Conventions were put together, what they meant, and that sort of thing.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, I made those statements within a matter of a few days of the initial publication of the memo. Now, in the last 2 weeks, more documents have come to light. In fact, they've been published by the New Yorker magazine on their website, New Yorker Online. Documents that were written by the legal counsel of the State Department, and which he did in 41 pages of tremendous detail. He went over all the points made in these memos and explained how they were simply incorrect, false. False with respect to the facts, false with respect to the presentation of U.S. Military doctrine and U.S. Diplomatic tradition. So it's quite clear that at the time these decisions were taken, the corrections had been presented to the administration. They were just ignored.
Who else in the administration spoke up against this? Anyone?
Well, I know that there were three major sources of opposition to this movement within the administration. Those were, first of all, the State Department. And the State Department, one thing that was interesting about the first Bush administration is that the State Department was dominated by career military people, in fact. Colin Powell, of course, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff himself, and he brought with him a number of other senior military figures. They spoke in support of traditional military interpretations of these issues. Second major source was the Joint Chiefs of Staff within the Pentagon, who were very, very clear in saying that they wanted the application of traditional military doctrine to these issues. And the third source were the JAG Corps. In fact, some of the same people who came to visit me, they were outspoken in saying that the law had to be followed, and the Geneva Conventions had to be applied here.
Well, they were really scared that they were going to get the blame, right? Because isn't it their job to make sure that interrogations are conducted lawfully?
That's exactly right. I mean, the way the military justice system plays out, it's uniformed soldiers who are prosecuted when things go wrong and when the law is disobeyed. It's not civilian political leaders. So I think that's one of the reasons they spoke so strongly here. I think they were very concerned about what was going to happen, frankly, what was going to happen to grunts out in the field.
Yeah, interesting that Colin Powell, who, as far as I know, is the only member of the cabinet in the first Bush administration who had seen combat at all, he opposed it, while all the rest of the chicken hawks in their civilian suits thought it was a great idea.
Well, in fact, if you go through, we can now make a decision chart about all the people who are involved in this issue within the administration, the individuals, and you can put them on one side either for application of the Geneva Convention or on the other against it, and one fact will determine whether or not these people were for or against the Geneva Convention, and that's this: did they serve in their country's military or not? Every single person who wore a uniform understood the importance of the Geneva Conventions and supported their application. Those who opposed it were people who dodged the draft and never served.
What a coincidence. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Horton. We'll be right back. Interview show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and my guest this hour is Scott Horton. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights. And sir, despite all the recent news, the conventional wisdom that the torture at the abuse at Abu Ghraib was strictly the result of a couple of bad apples spoiling the whole barrel, it seems to have worked. In fact, last week, MSNBC Newsweek had an article on their website about how torture is basically a dead issue, politically speaking, that there's no pressure for the Congress to hold real hearings. It wasn't an issue during the presidential campaign. And apparently nobody really cares except you and me.
Well, I think that's, you know, very sad if it's true. But, you know, I'm not, certainly not convinced that it's true. You know, I hear about the issue continuously, and I know within the military it's a big issue right now. If you look at the hearings that were held on the nomination of Judge Gonzalez to be Attorney General, you saw that the opposition to Judge Gonzalez was led from the beginning by a completely surprising source, which was retired generals and admirals who were very upset at what he had done on the torture issue.
And yet he'll have no problem being confirmed.
They were expressing views really of grassroots military around the country.
In the end, though, he will have no problem being confirmed or Cherikov.
He was confirmed.
I'm sorry?
He was confirmed.
Oh, yeah, it already happened. There you go.
He was confirmed, but he had a record number of votes against him.
Okay, well, and we'll see how it goes, whether his opinions get better or worse from here.
But there is going to be another measure. I mean, the American Bar Association, again with the backing and support of retired military leaders, has announced this week a push for the creation of a commission of inquiry to look into this, an independent commission of inquiry, and legislation is going to be introduced to do that, and that's going to be pushed through in Congress. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. And I think beyond all that, Scott, you know, we're going to be seeing every single week for the next year stories coming out about this with more and more gruesome abuse every single week. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of material that's been gathered through internal Department of Defense investigations, Department of the Army investigations. Donald Rumsfeld has been sitting on that, trying to block its release and block it from becoming public. And he can slow things down, but he can't stop it from getting out. It is going to get out. And you're going to see that, in fact, the materials that have come out to date about Abu Ghraib were the tip of an iceberg. There's much, much more, and the most gruesome, revolting things have not yet come out.
In fact, just yesterday, the ACLU received a giant pile of documents from a lawsuit. There's a story about it today on the BBC News website, where there's more and more evidence. And in fact, there's also a story about there were pictures of mock executions where they would stick guns in prisoners' mouths and dry fire them, and that they had taken pictures of a lot of that in Afghanistan. But now some of them have admitted that they took part, but also admit that they destroyed the pictures.
And that's right. I mean, there was a major effort made to destroy evidence of all of this. And I know there's a major report that was completed about Afghanistan that's going to come out that's going to include a lot of detail about this. And one thing that this does is it, you know, destroys completely the suggestions that Donald Rumsfeld wants to put out there that this is a few rotten apples doing things. These are American soldiers who are doing what they have been trained and instructed to do. And the people who made these policies that's producing these abuses are the ones who should be held to account, much more than the grunts who are following their instructions. And instead what we're seeing is, you know, court-martials of people like Grainer and Linda England and a number of others.
Well, here in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have to go out to another break, but then we'll have a nice long segment after that. And I'd like to get into a little more of the story about exactly which bad apples in what departments were doing these orders. We can talk about Copper Green and some of the material that Seymour Hersh has uncovered and stuff. But I think it'd be worthwhile at this point to mention the effectiveness of torture as a technique anyway. Last week on LouRockwell.com, Anthony Gregory asked the question, why should we believe that torture works any better than, say, rent control or any other government program?
Well, I think this is a question that's been studied for hundreds of years, and there's a lot of professional material on it. It all boils down to the conclusion that torture doesn't work, in fact. When you apply it, it gets people to say what they think the torturer wants to hear, not the truth. And I think we've already seen from the use of torture in at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, we have gotten consistently bad intelligence from this.
I've actually read news stories where the guy is telling about his experience in American-controlled prisons in Iraq, saying that he told them, hey, I am Osama bin Laden. I did it. It's me. Just go ahead and kill me now.
That's right. I mean, that's a very typical story, in fact.
And it's pretty sad to think that the American myth, I guess, the whole idea of liberty and justice for all and the rule of law and Judeo-Christian concepts of morality and individual liberty, all that just goes out the window during wartime, doesn't it?
Well, it's also a question of just effective intelligence gathering, because this isn't effective. It just corrupts the system.
All right, it's a weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton, and we're talking with Scott Horton. We'll be right back.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and my guest is Scott Horton, no relation. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights. And Mr. Horton, in July of 2003, you said, Donald Rumsfeld held a meeting where he complained about the lousy intelligence being gathered from arrested insurgents in Iraq, and said he wanted to gitmoize the process. What exactly does that mean, and how did they go about gitmoizing it?
Well, he had already authorized the introduction of a new regime of interrogation and treatment of detainees in Gitmo at Guantanamo. And that was a regime, you know, that was far more aggressive than anything the U.S. Military had done in the last 40 or 50 years. So it was an amendment to the Department of the Army field manual. He had done that against opposition of a lot of military, particularly including the Judge Advocate General's staff, military lawyers.
But the war in Iraq was being conducted as a traditional war against a nation state, so
that's
these
exactly right.
Wouldn't
the whole
apply,
concept
right?
behind doing this in Guantanamo was that the Geneva rules didn't apply, so therefore you could get down and dirty with these people. He then ordered that that technique be taken and introduced in Iraq, which meant basically violating the rights of the prisoners there because they were entitled to be treated under the Geneva and the Hague Convention rules. He sent General Jeffrey Miller, who ran Guantanamo at that point, out to Iraq to supervise the introduction of the Guantanamo system, to Gitmoize it. And in fact, it's within a period of weeks from the arrival of General Miller in Iraq that you begin to see abuses going on all over the place. I mean, extremely rough treatment of Iraqi flag officers and field officers, several of whom were murdered, and others. So, you know, there's a direct connection between Donald Rumsfeld's order and the abuses, including ultimately the abuses of Abu Ghraib.
Well, let's name some names of some guilty parties here. Best I can tell, Donald Rumsfeld and his undersecretaries for his undersecretary and his undersecretary for policy, Douglas Feith, and Paul Wolfowitz are involved. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, is in on it.
I would put General Myers in the middle of this, nor would I put Paul Wolfowitz in the middle of it. I mean, based on all the documentation I've seen so far, Douglas J. Feith certainly is right in the center of all of this. He had responsibility for formulation of detainee policy, so he clearly was deeply involved in this.
Didn't you write that Richard Myers had signed off on it?
No, I didn't write that. It might be true that he had, but I just don't know exactly how far he was involved in it. Certainly, Joint Chief of Staff signed off on the Guantanamo policies, no doubt about that.
All right, but not necessarily moving those policies to...
But no, in fact, that's a whole area. The involvement of the Joint Staff and the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the process in Iraq is something that has to be investigated and made clear because we really don't have a lot of documents that set that out in detail. But Stephen Cambone, another deputy of Donald Rumsfeld, we do have his fingerprints all over everything. So it's quite clear he was very deeply involved in it, including this process of gitmoizing.
Well, when it comes to investigations, we really only have internal executive branch investigations to rely on because Congress is completely AWOL on this issue.
I agree with that. In fact, I worked with a couple of members of the Senate Armed Services Committee and their staffs when they were investigating earlier, and I was really shocked at the low quality of investigative work that was being done by the Senate Armed Services Committee. I think you got a couple of senators who did a really good, diligent job. In fact, I'd say Lindsey Graham from South Carolina probably is the person who did the best job. After him, maybe Jack Reed and a few others. But the quality of the Senate committee's work overall was terrible.
So basically, if Americans want to know about their government's ghost prisons all around the world, basically they'll have to read The Guardian or some European newspaper to find out that source because it's not in the news here.
Well, I think you're going to see, you know, there's a lot of investigative work being done by journalists in the United States right now. They are lagging behind. I think, as you say, actually European papers have been on top of this before them. But I think, for instance, if people pick up Newsweek, which is going to be out on the stands on Monday, they're going to find in it a very revealing new report about the ghost detainees. Subject, and CBS 60 Minutes is probably going to do one or two programs on this as well. A number of other publications in the U.S. working on it. I think it's probably going to be maybe another month or a month and a half before we see major headway made on the story, but it's coming.
Well, and they're only three quarters of a year behind The Guardian. That's not too bad, I guess.
And that's sort of the way it normally runs.
What sort of tortures are we talking about here? In terms of techniques, I guess we commonly hear about waterboarding.
Well, waterboarding is a technique that was approved for a brief period of time in Guantanamo and then subsequently revoked. But the techniques, we have official descriptions of them, which don't give us a lot of detail. But we know from the FBI papers and the Defense Intelligence Agency papers that have come out a little bit better how things have played out. And that has included chaining people for prolonged periods of time to the floor of a room with an air conditioning unit cranked up and with the people stripped naked, essentially, so they're left to wriggle in their own urine and feces over a long period of time. And this has produced close to insanity in some people. And certainly over a long period of time can constitute torture. It also includes holding people up in stress positions, which can result in dislocation of shoulders, of arms from their sockets and things of this sort. And physical beatings, in fact, have been a regular mainstay of the regime that's been observed and reported in Guantanamo. Then we have practices that are designed to show our contempt for the religious views of people, which has included shaving beards, making disparaging statements about religious beliefs, wrapping Muslims in Israeli flags, suggesting that they could only have food that's not halal, which is to say, not prepared in accordance with religious rituals. And this is the sort of conduct that we condemned it when the Nazis did it in World War II. We said it was subhuman and improper. And now we see it's being brought in as part of an official regime. And we've got the sexual humiliation techniques that were being used. And with respect to those things, Rush Limbaugh and others like to crack jokes about it, saying that they should sit back and relax and enjoy it. But the test that we've got to apply is, let's just think the people in these prisons are American soldiers who are being held captive, who are being subjected to practices designed to embarrass and ridicule them. What would you think about that?
The senators who saw some of the information that hasn't been made public yet, according to some reports, came out of the room ash and white and said that it was some of the most horrible stuff, far worse than anything that had been released so far. And that was almost a year ago itself.
That's right. And, some of what they saw were photographs of rapes being undertaken with the supervision of prison guards.
Indeed. How would Americans feel if our soldiers were being treated this way? And as a corollary to that, what better way would there be to guarantee that our soldiers are treated this way than doing it first?
And well, I think there's nothing that says more about a society than the way it treats people who are held in its power. It's one thing when you have people, you're holding people in prison because of a crime and there's an intent of punishing them. But when you're dealing with people who've been swept off the field of battle, and you're taking them out of battle and dealing with them as potential combatants, you haven't made any judgment about whether these people have committed a crime or not. To treat them in this way is not appropriate. And that's something that's been a fundamental American value, frankly, since George Washington. In fact, George Washington issued an order on Christmas Day, 1776, in which he said, no detainee captured by the Continental Army will suffer abuse or mistreatment of any kind. That was his first standing order.
The Red Cross said that they were informed by the military that between 70 and 90% of the people in Abu Ghraib were innocent. And in fact, there was an article in Esquire magazine, I believe January's issue of Esquire, where they talk with the man who is most likely the man in the picture, covered in a hood, in the Christ pose with electric wires hooked up to his hands and his genitals, standing on a box. And they interviewed him, and he said that he was standing on the side of the street. And that was his crime that he got arrested and thrown in Abu Ghraib for, this guy that they electrocuted.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who worked in military intelligence units, including the 321st, that were active at Abu Ghraib, and they all say, of course, they understood that from the beginning. These were people who were caught up in broad street sweeps and brought to the prison. That would account for at least three-quarters, maybe 90%, of the total prison population. You have a very small part of that prison population who were serious criminals or people who were suspected of acts of violence or terrorism. Very small part of the population. And, you know, the problem was then beginning these sweeping techniques of abuse against people who were guilty of absolutely nothing and, frankly, who should have been released. It was tremendously damaging to our efforts in Iraq.
Can I ask you a question about the court-martial of Charles Grainer?
Right.
I saw there's an article in The Guardian today, or perhaps yesterday, about a man named Manadel Al-Jamadi. And he's the man in the pictures, the released Abu Ghraib pictures, where Charles Grainer and a young blonde-haired woman are standing over this man's corpse with giving the big thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
And The Guardian has an article that says they now know how he died. They cuffed his wrists behind his back, and then they hung him from the ceiling. And his, as you described earlier, with arms coming out of sockets and such, it broke many of his ribs when they finally cut him down. Blood poured out of his mouth, quote, like a faucet, because of his broken ribs had punctured his lungs and such. And that's how he died. But I just wonder, how come, I have no evidence, I have no idea whether Charles Grainer actually was involved in the murder of this man, but he is pictured giving the big thumbs up over the man's corpse. And I wonder why was murder or accessory to murder not one of the charges against him at his court-martial?
Well, I think there's no evidence that connects either England or Grainer to the death of that particular detainee. In fact, the evidence that's been gathered so far connects his death to those who were involved in interrogation. And remember, Grainer and England were with the MP troops there. So they were responsible for safety in the facility and taking prisoners from the point of interrogation back to their cell. But they were not involved in any way in the interrogation. That detainee suffered very, very serious abuse at the hands of interrogators. And that includes, in fact, if you look at the Guardian article, they do discuss this a little bit. But, I mean, this is a matter that, you know, has not, there's no prosecution yet pending on it. But the interrogators in this case included military interrogators and so-called other government agency, in quotes, which usually means the CIA, interrogators. And one of the big questions here is we've got other government agency interrogators connected to some of the most brutal cases, now, including cases involving the death of detainees. There's not been a single prosecution of a CIA functionary in connection with any death or serious wounding of a detainee, which is more than puzzling.
Well, and it goes back to the story that if we just say bad apples over and over again, that meme will basically be successful and the people will accept it.
People might actually, I mean, it's what we call the big lie theory. I mean, you repeat a lie enough, and some people will actually begin to believe it.
Can I ask you, Mr. Horton, which, if any, members of the Bush administration are guilty of perjury for their testimony in front of the Congress?
Well, you know, that's something that we'll know when we have a full investigation conducted. But I will tell you, if you go back and look at those initial hearings, you'll see that Rumsfeld's deputy, Stephen Cambone, came out and talked about a number of things, including the Pentagon's relations with the Red Cross. And the very next day, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, gave an interview to the Baltimore Sun in which he contradicted Cambone on every single point of his statement. And I think there comes a point when someone makes so many inaccurate statements, you've got to say he's lying. And I think, you know, Mr. Cambone reaches that point.
All right. I'm about ready to switch gears into some broader foreign policy questions, but I want to give you a chance to say any last comments on the torture question.
Well, I think we're going to see this issue continue to unfold over the next half year, and I think it's going to finally be resolved when we get a decent Secretary of Defense appointed, because I think all we need is a Secretary of Defense with an ounce of conscience and restoration of traditional American military rules, and this issue would go away immediately. And I think that's what we all got to pray for.
Yeah, well, we certainly blew our chance to replace him last November. It's hard to imagine what particular pressure could be applied to get Rumsfeld fired at this point. Except maybe if Bill Kristol and the guys at the Weekly Standard decide they don't like him anymore.
Well, I think they've already decided they don't like him, but it didn't seem to make any difference.
Not so far. All right. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest is Scott Horton, no relation. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights and is the director of the Council on Foreign Relations Center for Preventive Action. And I wanted to ask you, you know, I've been looking at the news the past few days, and I see George Bush telling Syria that they better pull out of Lebanon. See him accusing Iran of developing nuclear weapons, saying very publicly that he would support Israel if Israel starts a war with Iran. And I'm really curious as to what's the mood like at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Are most of the members of the CFR, are they for the neoconservative policy of remaking the Middle East, or are most of you guys kind of nervous about this, or?
Well, I think, you know, the group has a membership that's drawn from all over the country and from people in all different phases of life, so there's hardly a group mentality there. I mean, there are neocon members, and there are traditional liberal members, and there are traditional conservative members, so you've got sort of all different viewpoints reflected. I think there is generally a lot of apprehension about the administration's penchant to deal with everything on a military footing. And I think there's a sense that, frankly, the budget doesn't have the money to do much more of this.
All right. I'm sorry. I'll have to hold you right there, Mr. Horton. We're going out to break. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back to wrap up with Scott Horton from the International League for Human Rights. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Horton. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights. And before the break, sir, I asked you about whether the neoconservative policy for remaking the Middle East has broad support within the foreign policy establishment in this country. And you were saying that in some circles it seems there's some reluctance to go about everything in such a militaristic fashion. And then right about then is when I cut you off to go to the break. So,
well, I think, you know, a lot of it's going to come down to money. You know, a campaign was waged in Afghanistan. Campaign is still underway in Iraq. The cost of this is staggering. If it now expands to military campaigns against Syria or Iran, these will probably be at least as much as the Iraq war, probably in the case of Iran, a multiple of that. Where does the money come from for this? Deficit spending is already completely out of control. And the long-term damage that this is going to bring to the economy is clear.
Well, Mr. Horton, I'm a libertarian type myself, and I guess that means I'm mostly for the idea that America should be unilaterally at peace. And I've never been much of a fan of the United Nations, but I wonder what you think of when you hear Richard Perle. I have a quote here from an article he wrote called Thank God for the Death of the United Nations that he wrote for The Guardian March 21st, 2003. He said, Saddam Hussein's reign of terror is about to end. He will go quickly, but not alone. In a parting irony, he will take the UN down with him. Well, not the whole UN. The good works part will still survive. The low-risk peacekeeping bureaucracies will remain. The chatterbox on the Hudson will continue to bleat. What will die is the fantasy of the UN as the foundation of a new world order. As we sift the debris, it will be important to preserve the better to understand the intellectual wreckage of the liberal conceit of safety through international law administered by international institutions.
Well, I think that, you know, Richard Perle and his views... First of all, let me say, I think there are many really valid criticisms to be made of the United Nations. The United Nations is not what the founders envisioned it would become. In fact, it is the sum of all of its parts. And if you look at the nations that are members of the United Nations, most of them are corrupt, totalitarian, or authoritarian regimes. And that predisposition then becomes reflected in the UN as an institution itself. So there are very severe problems with it. But then Richard Perle's idea of wishing ill and wishing death to this entire order, in order to bring about a new regime of American unilateralism is something that's extremely dangerous to the United States. Particularly if what this means is the United States engages in military escapades all over the world to try and reshape the world in its own image, that's going to bring us to our knees in very short order.
Yeah, we're sort of the last rogue state.
Well, we're rapidly becoming a rogue state. I mean, we are defying this international order, which we, in fact, created.
Yeah, we're all international laws to be enforced by the United States, which is exempt from it all.
That's right. And this makes us, instead of being the leader of the world, which is a position where we could accomplish a lot with minimum expenditure in terms of lives of soldiers and money, we in fact become an object of contempt and ridicule around the world, and it's very difficult for us to accomplish anything.
I want to thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Everybody's Scott Horton. He's the president of the International League of Human Rights. Thanks very much, sir.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
You too. All right, my friends, we'll be right back with the Weekend Interview Show.